From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's show, the energy company that lost its power. We talk about the Enron debacle with journalist Kurt Eichenwald. He's been covering the story for the New York Times. He'll tell us about Enron's dramatic turnaround from corporate leader to bankruptcy in a matter of months. We'll explore Enron's political connections and the events that led to the company's failure. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, a new collection of short stories by Alice Munro. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department has released photos and video excerpts of five men who may be planning terrorist attacks. The materials were found in Afghanistan in the bombed house of one of Osama bin Laden's top officials. The videos show the men making speeches that officials believe are declarations of their intentions to commit suicide attacks. Attorney General John Ashcroft urged the public to help locate, identify, and incapacitate the men. Israeli police say four people were reported killed and at least 20 injured in the northern city of Hadera, near the boundary separating Israel from the West Bank. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Initial reports said an assailant entered a hall where a bat mitzvah celebration was going on, wearing an explosive belt. Israel Army Radio reported that the attacker failed to set off the explosives, but did toss grenades into the crowd. Israeli television reported that the attacker also sprayed the crowd with gunfire before being shot and killed by police. It's the first suicide attack since Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat called for a ceasefire last month. In recent days, militant groups that had abided by the ceasefire said they were resuming their attacks because of what they called Israel's continued aggression. Hadera has seen a number of Palestinian attacks, including a suicide bus bombing in November. Israel has tightened its blockade in the West Bank as violence increases. Earlier in the day, a Palestinian militia leader was killed by Israeli soldiers. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
American troops in Bosnia are due to take custody of six Arabs who've been in prison there on suspicion of planning an attack on the U.S. embassy. U.S. officials say the six Arabs, five Algerians and a man from Yemen, could be transferred to the Guantanamo naval base in Cuba, where other suspected terrorists are being held. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from the Pentagon.
The six men were arrested in Bosnia last October after U.S. intelligence officials concluded the men were planning to attack the U.S. embassy in Sarajevo. But the U.S. government chose not to share all the information on the men's activities, according to a U.S. official, and without that information, there was insufficient evidence for the Bosnian government to hold the men any longer. The U.S. official says one of the six men was known to have close ties to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. The other five were allegedly accomplices. The Bosnian government is now prepared to turn the men over to the U.S. military for further investigation. The U.S. official says the six men are likely to be flown to the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo, Cuba, within the next few days. Tom Jelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Enron Corporation says it has fired the Arthur Andersen accounting firm as its auditor. Washington attorney Robert Bennett, who represents Enron, said the failed energy firm was troubled by reports that Enron destroyed documents related to the audit. In stocks today, the Dow gained 137 points to close at 9,850 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 41 points. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in Britain have charged two Algerian men with belonging to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. The men are suspected of involvement in a plot to bomb the U.S. embassy in Paris last fall. 30-year-old Brahmin bin Muzuga was also charged with directing and inciting terrorism. Baghdad Mezian, who's 36, was charged with possession of racist videos. Police said they arrested eight other men today in the city of Leicester, north of London, in connection with an ongoing anti-terrorist investigation. Medical regulators in Oregon have voted to discipline a doctor who they say improperly helped nearly 900 patients obtain medical marijuana ID cards. Colin Fogarty reports from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
Oregon is one of 9 states that allow patients to smoke marijuana for illnesses such as cancer or multiple sclerosis. Dr. Philip Levesque believes so strongly in the treatment that half of the 1,800 patients on the program received a recommendation from him. Those include a teenager. And in one case, Levesque recommended marijuana tea for an infant. He did not physically examine some patients. The Oregon Board of Medical Examiners says that falls well below standards of care. The panel ordered Levesque to receive a physical and psychological examination, and it set the stage for Levesque to be fined or have his medical license revoked. Levesque's supporters say he's the victim of a witch hunt. For NPR News, I'm Colin Fogarty in Portland, Oregon.
A 4-member team from the International Red Cross arrives today at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to inspect the living conditions of prisoners from Afghanistan. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is recovering from laryngitis. I'm Barbara Bogave. Enron was founded in 1985 by Kenneth Lay in a merger of 2 natural gas pipeline companies. 10 years later, it was the 7th biggest corporation in America. In the process, it transformed the nation's energy industry. Now, in what seems a matter of weeks, Enron has tumbled headlong into bankruptcy, costing employees and shareholders tens of billions of dollars in losses. Several federal investigations have begun to look into whether the company deliberately misled investors and if its legal and auditing firms colluded in the process. The story of Enron's failure has also focused a spotlight on the company's close connections to many members of Congress and the Bush administration. Stories about Enron have been all over the news recently, so I asked my guest, New York Times investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald, what makes this more than just another example of a big company going bankrupt?
Enron veers into a slightly different world. There have been large collapses in the past of companies like Drexel Burnham Lambert, which went under in 1990. Or long-term capital management, which almost went under but was ultimately bailed out. But in this instance, what you have is probably the most dramatic turnaround that I've ever witnessed. You had a company that at the beginning of the year the competitors were envious of the fact that this was a company that was so tight with the Bush administration. They were attending the inaugural. They were financing the parties at the inaugural. They were in Washington. They were their power and their influence were the things of fear. People talked about how they controlled the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And ultimately, the story on Enron, which was already being told, seemed to be this was going to be a company whose power needed to be watched because it had the potential of abusing it and it had the potential of misusing it. It had been involved in the whole California energy crisis as the chief villain. And so when you have a company that is already getting onto the radar screen in a very prominent way as a company of such great power, of such great influence, and then you wake up one morning and it's gone. It transforms the world, and it's a corporate collapse unparalleled from any other. And then there's one more element. I write a lot about corporate crime, corporate corruption, and corporate bankruptcies. And in this instance, unlike many of the others, it's not arguable about whether or not there are victims here. You know, in many of the previous cases, the victims were things like the market or, Wall Street traders or other high-level concepts or people you don't feel too sorry for. In this one, you have thousands on thousands of employees who very painfully have lost not only their retirement savings but also all of their security, where do they go from here? And so that combination of two things, real victims, And the most dramatic turnaround I've ever seen just has propelled this to a major corporate scandal.
I'd like you to help us understand the arc of Enron's collapse. And you write that Enron was a driving force behind a radical shift in the nation's energy policy, and that was a large part of its significance. Enron pioneered the trading of energy on the open market. Could you explain just how radical a departure this was from the way the energy business traditionally had been run?
Well, what Enron intended to do was to create a consistent supply at a consistent price. It was a mechanism that had been used for other commodities, and they intended to essentially get over all the peaks and valleys in pricing that were found in the energy business by committing to the delivery of energy through the trading mechanism and then trading it again and again and again and again. Each time, hopefully, capturing a little bit more in profit, they were able to essentially provide a more reliable supply of energy at a more reliable, predictable price. At the same time, they played a big role in Washington in terms of pushing forward deregulation of areas in the energy field. For example, gas pipelines had been very heavily regulated in the past, and Enron was a chief advocate and was very successful in getting pipelines deregulated so that more than one competitor, more than one group could use a pipeline owned by a particular individual or a particular company.
So how did Enron wield its influence on the federal government to help build this empire, to deregulate the markets?
Largely by keeping up the pressure, largely by knowing that power is found not on the sexy side of Washington's, but in areas like FERC, the Energy Regulatory Commission, in areas where their business is affected, and they were trying to obtain things like a federalized electric grid, which right now electricity is regulated on a state by state basis. That creates all sorts of difficulties for those who want to be involved in massive electric trading, which is what one of the things Enron was involved in. And so they would try, and they were having some great deal of success in terms of pushing forward the concept of a federalized electric grid. The end point of that, I mean, if you think about it, that's in the old days we would talk about states' rights, and that's the kind of thing that people are fairly comfortable having local regulation of their electricity grid, of their power grid. And when Enron was coming forward with this idea, it was the folks, the Republicans in Washington, who were advocating it, which was sort of a sign of how much influence Enron had. To a degree, people in Washington respond to success. They respond to success and they respond to campaign contributions. Enron had transformed this market over a course of 10 years and had gone from pretty much of a nothing to one of the largest corporations in America. That gives you the ability to say, hey, we know what we're doing. You should listen to us. You are just a bureaucrat. You should listen to us. And that may or may not have worked with the regulators. It certainly did work with the politicians.
Now, Enron was, at least at first, fabulously successful. By 1995, they become the biggest player in the natural gas business. They controlled one-fifth of the North American market. Where did the problem start? What went wrong?
What went wrong is, it's funny, it's sort of the same thing I've seen again and again with corporations. They're successful at one thing. They're successful in one area. And they see their stock price go up, and they conclude that they're geniuses. The folks at Enron were very open about talking about how smart they were. And they were ultimately, despite all their objections to this description, they were ultimately a trading company. Where the problems came in is that they decided to go into to build themselves up into certain hard asset businesses, which was very strange because at the same time they were saying the assets or asset businesses are not the way to go. But they tried to become, for example, the world's largest water company, and that was all a series of hard assets. They tried to go into broadband business. This was going to be their future. Broadband trading. They built plants. They had a plant in India. They had a plant in Brazil. One person described it to me that, in trading they had the golden touch, but when it came to their asset plays, everything they touched turned to mud. That tied up about $12 billion of the company's capital in very poor producing assets. Now, if you think about it, if people knew how bad that was, Enron would have been paying a price in the market much, much earlier. And so these folks came up with a very simple idea. If the assets aren't working, take them off the books. And that's where the problem gets started.
Kurt Eichenwald is a senior writer for the New York Times. He's been covering the investigation into the downfall of the Enron Corporation. Kurt, we'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He's been covering the Enron corporate scandal for the paper. Enron used limited partnerships to hide assets and these massive debts to inflate the revenues and make the company look as if it was in better shape than it really, really was to keep up investor confidence. Explain to us what the problem with that was. And are we talking about an illegal practice or a very gray area?
I'll start off with the part that's the most frightening. What you just described is legal. Now, that doesn't mean that these folks didn't commit crimes, but what you just described is legal. And it certainly should raise a question in the minds of listeners, investors, and the rest about what do we really know about corporations that can engage in these transactions. What Enron did in setting up these limited partnerships was essentially set up a dump site. They set up a place where things on their books that were unattractive could go. And so they would have these transactions with the partnerships that arguably, and they maintained this for some time internally, and a lot of people didn't know about the existence of the partnerships, that arguably were not part of Enron, but were a separate entity. So therefore, if I took my lousy assets or my debts and shifted it into this unrelated entity, I no longer had to report it on my books. The result of that, now, while legal, it was a farce. You would have Enron controlling 49% of a partnership. You would have the other 51% controlled by someone, an offshore law firm, for instance, that was working for Enron. And ultimately, Enron executives controlled the transactions of the partnerships. Enron executives controlled the other side of it. All of the decisions were being made for the benefit, well, hopefully for the benefit of Enron. And so in the end, these partnerships were acting as a portion of the company. Now, that's where the problem comes in, because by moving the assets off the books and putting them into these entities and then pretending they don't exist, Enron set itself up for catastrophe. Ultimately, the partnerships were determined to, in fact, be related entities to Enron, and entities that had to be reported. And so once you folded them back in, you now had all of this stuff that was in these partnerships, all the things that had been placed there, back in the company. And suddenly, the reporting of the company has to be restated. Going back to 1997, you have shareholders' equity wiped out to the tune of $1.2 billion. And the image of the company that then exists is not what folks have thought it was over the past few years.
Aren't there generally corporate processes and mechanisms and institutions in place that catch these irregularities, that point these problems out before the thing spins out of control, which it seems to have in this case?
The one thing that I have noticed time and again, because basically what I write about is corporate scandal, and what I've noticed time and again is you have the same underlying themes in almost every scandal. One is a group of executives who believe they are changing the world. A level of arrogance and a level of greed that you don't see in other corporations. And then the third, and probably the most significant, is a lack of adequate compliance procedures. You don't have people with teeth who are there for the purpose of making sure that everything is done not only to the letter but to the nth degree of how it should be done. In this situation, you had something. I was talking to the head of internal audit at a major corporation the other day, and he was just going on and on about he's never heard of anything like what Enron was doing. Enron had an outside auditor, Arthur Andersen, which we've been hearing about quite a bit recently, and then Enron had its own internal audit function. Now, internal audit is usually handled by a division of the company called internal audit. But and the idea is to serve as a check. You've got two audits, an internal audit and external audit, and everybody's making sure everything's done correctly. In this instance, internal audit was done by Arthur Andersen. It was contracted out to Arthur Andersen, to Andersen Consulting. And as a result, you had effectively the same firm handling both internal and external audit. And when you go through the company's filings, and they have meetings of the board of directors, of the audit committee, meeting with the head of internal audit. Well, they don't meet with the head of internal audit. They meet with the person who's in charge of the contract for dealing with the internal auditors who are coming from outside. This might sound like hair splitting. It might sound like, oh well, you know, who really cares about these things? But it's one of the key checks and balances. It's one of the things that you have to have to prevent a corporation from going off the tracks. You know, there's nothing wrong with a company being aggressive. There's nothing wrong with a company rewarding its employees. There's nothing wrong with a company trying to change the world if they can actually do it. But if you're going to do that, the one thing that every corporation has to understand is they have got to have very strong, empowered compliance officers, because it is too easy to go off the tracks, and companies do it again and again. Enron went off the tracks into the ocean and over to the other side of the country.
What happened in the end that Wall Street started looking into these limited partnerships, that they came to the light of day?
There were several drumbeats that preceded the ultimate run on Enron. The chief executive of the company, Jeffrey Skilling, announced in August that he was leaving, just a matter of months after he was put in. That started people wondering, well, you know, why would somebody get the brass ring and then leave? You see that in instances where there's a problem. Now, Skilling has maintained that his decision was purely personal, but that didn't stop people from wondering, and the questions started being asked. Enron had consolidated the partnerships into the company, and once they consolidated the partnerships into the company, all of the problems that existed became evident. On October 16th of 2001, Enron announced that they had lost 600, they expected to lose something like 600 some odd million dollars in the third quarter, but more importantly, that $1.2 billion in shareholders' equity had been wiped out. And that had happened because of the consolidation. Enron had been secretive, and I wouldn't use this as a legal term, just as a man on the street term, and deceptive for many years. People could not quite figure out how the company made its money. And so now you had a company in a massive crisis of confidence because people are wondering what is really happening, that could not get a single story out quickly. They tried to do a deal with Dynegy, a competitor, a merger deal, and ultimately that fell apart because Dynegy couldn't figure out the company's finances, couldn't figure out what was going on. As that inability to figure out what was going on unfolded, the stock kept going down and down and down. Finally, you had the critical point where all of the securities, equity, debt, stock debt, everything, were collapsing. The financial condition was deteriorating. The credit rating agencies were downgrading the debt. And you had traders at other firms saying, if I engage in a trade with Enron, ultimately, am I going to get my money? And so traders started backing away from trading with the company. That was it. That was death. There was nothing they could do to get around that. And so by that point, Enron was in a death spiral that it couldn't get out of.
Kurt Eichenwald has been covering the Enron debacle for the New York Times. He's the author of a book about corporate crime at Archer Daniels Midland called The Informant, A True Story. We'll continue our conversation with Kurt Eichenwald in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Peddler's Grandson, Growing Up Jewish in Mississippi by Edward Cohen, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the collapse of energy giant Enron Corporation. We continue our conversation with journalist Kurt Eichenwald. He's been covering the story for The New York Times. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new collection of short stories by Alice Munro.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue now our interview with investigative reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He's been covering the Enron Corporation's collapse for the New York Times. Eichenwald is also the author of The Informant, a true story about corporate crime at ADM. Help us understand how Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm in charge of auditing the Enron books, fits into this scandal. We've been hearing a lot about them in the news. Last week they disclosed that employees had destroyed many documents related to the audits, and this week they fired the partner in charge of the Enron account. What do all these developments add up to, and what do they tell us about their involvement in any possible fraud?
Andersen is so deep in the Enron case that they are, in fact, at this point, certain to be a subject of the criminal investigation. Enron is because of its strange way it functioned. Again, you had Arthur Andersen as we're serving in the internal and external audit functions. You have a number of Enron employees in significant positions having worked for Arthur Andersen. And there was certainly a revolving door between Andersen and Enron. So you now have this very, very close relationship. Andersen was fully apprised of what was going on in the partnerships. Well, Andersen maintained at certain points that it was fully apprised of what was going on in the partnerships and later said that it was being deceived. You had the Houston office of Andersen that was directly involved in auditing this material. You had questions relating to the partnerships being relayed up to the Chicago office, the main office of Arthur Andersen. And so they were very, very deep in all of this. Now, they very well may have been able to step aside. You know, again, we don't know yet what the documents are going to show. But they very well may have been able to maintain, you know, we had no knowledge of any impropriety and we did the auditing function correctly and just do everything that all the auditors who find themselves in this situation do. Then came the documents destruction. This week, they did announce that they were firing the partner in charge of the Enron assignment and that he had effectively ordered up a shredding party. And the timing of that was disastrous. The timing of that, had he been doing it at a point when, I'm just clearing out my books, well, maybe. But according to the Andersen statement that came out this week, this started on a huge scale after Enron was contacted by the Securities and Exchange Commission and asked for documents pertaining to the partnerships. Supposedly, and Andersen says, it was something like the next day, and this partner in charge of the account had a meeting where he said we're having expedited destruction of documents, and people were sent out to delete emails, to get rid of files, to shred records. The Enron itself was subpoenaed by the SEC, was subpoenaed, not just a request for documents, which raises the level a little bit, was subpoenaed a couple of weeks later by the SEC. And the next day, an email went out from the secretaries involved in the shredding saying, stop the shredding. This is just a devastating fact pattern. This information is really extremely bad.
Political influence is such a large part of this Enron story. I'd like you to lay out the ties that Kenneth Lay, the chairman of Enron, and the Enron Corporation had both to Bush Sr. and George W. Bush.
Well, Enron's connections into the political world began because they had something they wanted. And ultimately, that was the energy deregulation. To get that done, beginning in the early 1990s, they hired lots of lobbyists and sent lots of campaign contributions to Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. And when it came time to create, really deep financial bonds with presidential candidates, it was the Bushes who ended up being the main recipients of that friendship and largesse. Ken Lay was a top contributor for Bush, and in 1992 he was chairman of the Republican National Convention, which nominated Bush Sr. For president. And when Bush Jr., when George W. came along, he had already established himself as a friend of his when he served as the Texas governor. When he ran for president, Mr. Lay was one of 214 folks called pioneers who raised $100,000 for the presidential campaign. And in addition, Lay was an advisor to Bush during the transition period when there was all that concern about who was actually going to be the president. So, you know, this is a man who has very close ties to the former president, the current president, and many people in Washington. If you look at all the people who are stepping down in the Enron investigation because of potential conflicts, I mean, that gives you a very good sense of how connected this company and these individuals were.
You're referring to Attorney General John Ashcroft, who's recused himself from the investigation because of.
I'm referring to everybody. you've had just quite a number of people raising concerns about, well, you know, should so and so be involved, and should I be involved, and so this is a company that just had very, very deep fingers into Washington.
Did Enron work both sides of the fence? Did they cultivate Democrats also?
Yes. I mean, it really doesn't work as a corporation to just go after one side. I mean, they clearly favored the Republicans, but they had a number of contacts and a number of close relationships with the Democrats as well.
So how unusual is this, though? All large corporations have cultivated political ties. They hire lobbyists. How is the Enron story anything other than business as usual in Washington?
Mainly by scale. I mean, it's the scale of what they were doing and what they were able to accomplish. They had goals. They were able to achieve a lot of those goals. And the next level is the level, the degree of friendship that Ken Lay had with the president. That is a bit unusual. There are plenty of corporations that give plenty of money and don't have a first name basis friendship with the president of the United States.
Do you see this shaping up as a political scandal for the president?
There's nothing I have seen yet to indicate that this is going to become a presidential scandal. Now, one major caveat to that, I have no idea. I don't know where this is going to go and what ultimately is going to be proven. But at this point, what you have is the administration was contacted about a corporation that was going under, that was run by a series of very close friends, and the corporation was allowed to go under. But had there been actions taken that were favorable towards Enron, well, then there would be people who would have questions to answer. But again, I have to emphasize, there's a lot of information that isn't known. A lot of the details of the partnerships. The partnerships have many, many investors, including high net worth individuals. We don't know who those people are yet. We don't know where ultimately these pieces are going to all fit together.
New York Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald. We'll continue our conversation about Enron after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He's been covering the Enron story for the New York Times. I think it's very hard in following this story to understand at what point unethical behavior wanders across the line into fraud. For instance, it came out this fall that while many employees of Enron lost their life savings when the company's stock crashed, many executives cashed out millions before it was too late, including Chairman Kenneth Lay. He sold $40 million worth of stock between, I think, January and August last year. And then at that point sent out a memo to his employees that reassured them about the future of the company and instituted a policy which prohibited them from cashing out their company stocks. What determines at what point these activities cross that line from unethical to out-and-out criminally fraudulent?
Well, one thing is that they didn't establish a policy that prevented people from selling. What happened is they had they changed the manager of the 401k plan. And by doing that, there was a period of time in which the manager, the folks in the 401k plan couldn't sell. Now, of course, the question is, well, you know, when did they decide to do that? And that was one of my earliest questions. And it ends up they decided to do that months before. So ultimately, there may be something more there, but at this point, that's what we know. What establishes fraud on all the other areas is a very murky concept, intent. What did they know and what were they intending to do? If the folks who were selling shares, for instance, at Enron sold the shares and made the money, there's nothing wrong with it. If they knew that this company was coming apart and that I don't think they expected it was going to collapse. But if they had reason to believe, based on material, non-public information, that this company was going to have some serious problems with its stock going forward, and then they sold, that's a crime. So it really, you can have the exact same behaviors, and in one instance, it's not a crime and potentially not even unethical. And in another instance, they're going to jail. That's why these kinds of investigations are so hard. You have to establish what did they know, when did they know it, and why did they do what they did.
Is anyone likely to see jail time in this? How do these white-collar corporate investigations usually play out?
I've never seen a white-collar case that has reached this level of magnitude, this level of investigation where somebody didn't go to jail. I think right now you've got the main thing for an investigation is the government is going to be going out trying to find those people at Enron who have bits and pieces of information that can help them. The folks who have no main stake in a criminal outcome but are willing to cooperate. They are also simultaneously going to be putting the pressure on the people who do have a stake in the criminal outcome, who are subjects or potential targets of the criminal investigation. And the main goal with them is first one in the door gets the deal. You know, flip, cooperate, and you get a deal. If you don't and someone else does, you're the target. It's a real race to the courthouse. And really what you've got is, you know, right now it's not really clear where the government's going with the investigation. The criminal side of it is clearly just getting started. But as it picks up steam, it's going to be who cuts a deal first. And that's really the big thing we need to be looking for is somebody going in to plead guilty to what would then be called a criminal information, which is part of a plea deal.
Do you see any longer-term fallout from Enron's collapse in terms of, say, a call for reform of rules governing retirement plans since thousands of Enron employee retirement accounts have been wiped out in this debacle, or a return to tighter regulation of the energy business?
Every time I see one of these scandals, you know, at the beginning I thought, well, now all the rules are going to change. And you know, the rules are changed a little bit here and there, but there never seems to be a major overhaul. In this one, I do think the highest likelihood for change is in the 401k area because you do have so many people who lost money and who weren't able to do anything about it. And that just, you know, strikes everybody as just not right. In the other areas, on energy regulation and the rest, I think there'll be lots of calls, lots of saber rattling, but I don't know if it's going to last through the point of actual legislation. This is a time where people need to stand back and look at what happened, figure it out, and figure out what the solutions could be. I hope that's what people do. Too often in the corporate scandals that I've seen, you know, the band moves on. And there are a few changes that are made, and then, you know, someday later another scandal emerges, another corporation gets involved in it, and the hullabaloo starts all over again.
I'm talking with Kurt Eichenwald. He's a senior writer at the New York Times. He's been covering the investigation into the demise of the Enron Corporation. You've reported on another investigation into a corporate meltdown in a series of articles on Columbia HCA Healthcare. And this company happened also to be founded by a major supporter of George W. Bush, Richard Rainwater. They were convicted of fraud in 1997, and they also happened to have been a company that transformed or reinvented a market, in their case, the HMO business. Do you see parallels between these two stories that you've covered or a thread running through these two tales of corporate scandal and bust?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. It's not just Columbia, but in virtually every corporate scandal I've covered, ADM, Prudential, Drexel, going back, the same themes always emerge. And it's the themes that you have a corporation where there is virtually a cult of support, a cult of arrogance, I want to say, where the people at the top truly have this almost messianic sense of their abilities. And, you know, again, there are companies that are like that, and it's fine as long as they then say, we need to be careful. But in each of these companies, compliance and, you know, all the things you need in place to follow the rules were just thrown into the back seat or thrown out of the car completely. And everything ran off of, well, we're smart, we're good, we can handle it, we know what we're doing, and we need to get the stock price up 20%. And, you know, ultimately, if you have that kind of mentality, you know, crooks don't wear ID cards. They don't announce themselves when they walk in the door. But they congregate to places like that. You know, fast money, big business, lots of power, very little oversight. And ultimately, if you don't have somebody there saying no, if you don't have a wise person to go along with all the smart people, they're going to veer off the tracks. They're going to end up in a scandal. You know, it's very rare. There's only been once where I've ever seen a scandal a corporate scandal that occurred because executives were sitting, you know, senior executives were sitting in a seat saying, go commit a crime. Almost every other time, it's just been this culture that has been created that allows for people to pretty much do whatever they want, and in the end, drive the company into a very serious circumstance.
Does it make it easier to perpetuate this culture of arrogance and secrecy when you're dealing in a market that you are reinventing? Everyone can pass the buck because they think, well, no one's ever really done this before, and no one really knows how this is supposed to work, so I suppose this is okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not so much, gee, nobody understands it, so maybe this is okay. We're kind of on uncharted ground. It's more we are changing the world. Don't stop us. You know, you who are raising questions simply don't understand. You know, you don't understand is a phrase that has emerged in every single one of these cases where you would see people raising warning signals, raising flags early on, and the response of senior management is, you don't understand. Columbia believed that they were changing the healthcare world. Columbia believed that hospitals were going to be completely changed and that the not-for-profit hospital system that exists in this country was, you know, archaic and in need of being replaced. And there are certainly problems with it. But Columbia came in with this cult of personality built around its chairman, a fellow named Richard Scott. And its messianic belief of its destiny. There was not quite the cult of personality at Enron, but there was this sense of messianic destiny. There was this level of arrogance, and these same things just, you know, emerge again and again, and they have to be controlled, because ultimately, if you think that the people who question you are simply ignorant or old world or are trying to stop inevitable change, then what in the world slows you down? What in the world keeps you from making the mistakes or the crimes that in the end blow up corporations and cause many people to lose their jobs?
Kurt Eichenwald, I want to thank you so much for talking today on the show.
Thank you very much.
New York Times reporter Kurt Eichenwald. He's the author of a book about another tale of corporate crime at Archer Daniels Midland called The Informant, A True Story. Coming up, a review of a new collection of short stories from Alice Munro. This is Fresh Air. The title of Alice Munro's latest short story collection, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, comes from a child's rhyme about women's romantic fates. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that the women in Munro's fiction often seem to experience all five fates at the same time.
If one of the marks of a superb work of literature is that after you read it, you can't shake it off, well, then Alice Munro's latest short story collection is surely one superb work of literature. Ever since reading Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, as this collection is called, I've been going about my daily routine haunted by the voices and gruff humor and sad histories of Munro's characters, mostly working-class Canadians circa 1950 or so. That may sound more like a curse than a gift. After all, stereotypically, Canada of the 1950s suggests dullness squared. But then think of the literary gold that James Joyce extracted out of gray and dirty Dublin almost a century ago. Munro, too, catches the glint of something precious within the drab, without her writing ever sounding precious. That's a move only the masters of language can pull off. There are 9 stories in this collection, and the best of them, like the title story, unexpectedly fan out so that you find your attention shifting from the main characters, mostly all women, to the shadowy minor figures with whom their lives crucially intersect. In the short story, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, a youngish old maid housekeeper named Johanna powders her underarms, puts on clean underwear, and resolutely pushes open the door of her town's one and only exclusive dress shop. She winds up buying a brown wool dress, and much to her own surprise, she tells the nosy shop owner that it'll likely be what I get married in. While we're still mulling over that revelation, so far in the story, no groom has appeared, and Johanna herself is a brusque creature who doesn't inspire much readerly affection. Munro steers us over to the limited prospect of the dress store owner's life, and then, just as gently, over to look at the life of the restless teenaged girl whose cruel prank is responsible for Johanna's pie-in-the-sky dreams, and for her eventual good fortune. It'll likely be what I get married in. That's the colloquial phrase Johanna utters that perfectly conveys her bluff assurance and her hesitance. Or listen to these words voiced by a character in the lesser but still evocative story called Floating Bridge. "We got the air conditioning," he proudly assures a visitor. I can't verify that mid-20th century working-class Canadians really talked this way, but I know people who still talk this way. The dialogue in these stories sounds vividly authentic, and Munro is just as astute at analyzing certain ways of talking as she is at rendering them. Here's how she describes a large family's holiday dinner conversations in an ultimately harrowing story called Family Furnishings. There was hardly any idea of a general conversation, and in fact there was a feeling that conversation that passed beyond certain understood limits might be a disruption, a showing off. The people at that table were quite capable of talk. Washing and drying the dishes in the kitchen, the aunts would talk about who had a tumor, a septic throat, a bad mess of boils. Mention of intimate bodily matters seemed never to be so out of place or suspect as the mention of something read in a magazine or an item in the news. Tone may be one of the most elusive literary qualities to nail down right. If condescension or sentimentality or, God forbid, bathos seeped into these stories, they would be a collective disaster. But when a character in the vivid story Queenie says of another that he was just a person who took comfort in the moment and in a sort of reasonable facade of life, all you hear in terms of tone is a down-to-earth frankness, a sense that Munro is granting that character the full grace of his limitations. Whatever Munro's limitations are as a writer, they're not showing in this wonderful collection.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, a new short story collection by Alice Munro. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with singer Paul McCartney. His latest CD is called Driving Rain. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I like it. Please don't take my heart away. It's happy where it is, so let it stay. You gave me love. You gave me rain.